Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of precious metals. I'm Paul Bresson.
And I'm Jason Ealing.
And you're precious too, buddy.
Oh, I wasn't fast enough. I was going to say, you're the most precious metal of all, bud.
Anyways. Dude, my allergies have been killing me this year. I swear they're getting worse and worse and worse every year. I had the thought today. I was like, by the time I'm 60, I'm probably just going to die.
Whoa.
They're getting so bad. Like, I'm not even going to be able to breathe anymore. I'm just going to inhale some pollen someday and fall over dead.
That got extreme fast.
Anyway, so how are you doing?
Well, I hadn't really thought about it, but now that you mention it, so like it was in my early 30s when allergies just started hitting me every spring. And at first I didn't even know what was going on. I just thought I had a really, really long cold.
Yeah.
But then I found out it was allergies, and it was like a reliable every year thing where I had to go buy all the medication. I got my trifecta of allergy medications to keep it under control.
I remember we went to Japan last fall.
Mm-hmm.
You went before me and you like took that hike and you like desperately texted me like, bro, you got to bring me allergy meds. I'm dying. Yeah.
That was weird because
the first time allergies hit you, though, you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
Am I sick?
Well, I always thought I was just better than everybody else because I had never experienced allergies. And when people talked about it, I was always like, you suckers.
Right. Like people that have broken bones before. Like, yeah. What? Yeah. Someday I'll break a bone and be like, no. And
drink more milk, people. Jeez. But since that time, when I texted you to bring me allergy meds, I haven't experienced allergies at all. This spring, nothing.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, maybe I'm...
You must be avoiding the chemtrails.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
That was a joke, by the way, I think.
Paul doesn't believe in chemtrails.
Maybe couldn't tell.
He can't see the truth. He hasn't opened his third eye.
Yeah. I haven't seen enough proof yet.
Yeah.
Other than that, though, I'm doing great, buddy.
Good. I'm glad.
We're talking about some cool stuff today. I'm excited for this episode.
Yeah, this will be good.
Coming up with the episode list, you know, we were like, we haven't done like a specific attraction for a while. And I think it might have been you that threw out like, let's do both of these together. And I immediately knew it was a great idea. One of your many great ideas.
Oh, thanks. Well, it seemed like it made sense to group them together. If we did one of them without the other, it would feel incomplete.
I agree.
Should we say it? We say what it is?
Yeah, please.
We're talking about two of the most famous temples in Kyoto, Kinkakuji, or the Temple of the Golden Pavilion, and Ginkakuji, the Temple of the Silver Pavilion. Kin means gold, gin means silver. Very similar words, easy to mix them up. I feel like my brain kept mixing them up in this research a little bit.
Yeah, I ran into that a little bit. Also feel like going through this episode, am I going to call them gold and silver? Am I going to call them Keen and Geen? They also have official names.
Yeah.
That we haven't even talked about yet that I'm definitely not going to use.
Should we...
Let's talk about the names. What do you got? You're the language guy. What do you got for naming on these things?
Do you mean like what's my preferred thing to call them? Or do you want me to talk about their actual names?
Both.
Okay. I'm going to first talk about their actual names.
Okay.
So... let's be real. Everybody calls them the Golden Pavilion or the Silver Pavilion or Kinkakuji or Ginkakuji, but those aren't their real names. Kinkakuji, the Golden Pavilion, its official name is Rokugonji. And Ginkakuji, the Silver Pavilion, is actually called Jishoji. But I'm telling you, nobody calls them that. You don't need to remember Rokugonji or Jishoji. No one's going to say that to you ever in your whole life. You might see them if you look on Google Maps. I think the Silver Pavilion is called Jishoji on Google Maps, but it's also whatever. It doesn't matter. No.
If you type in Silver Pavilion, it'll bring you there.
Yes, definitely. Just to keep things simple, do you want to call them Golden Pavilion and Silver Pavilion?
That's probably the easiest way to make sure I don't screw up.
Okay. I might find myself saying Kinkakuji or Ginkakuji, but when I do, I'll point out that's the silver one or the gold one. How about that? Okay.
And where do those official names come from?
Well, they're both temples, and I guess I was going to wait until we got to the history section to get
that,
but
that works.
I mean, we could spoil it.
Yeah, let's spoil it.
Okay. They're each named after the person that had them turned into a temple, but not the names that they had when they were alive. The temples are named after the names that these guys got after they died, which is common in Buddhism. Like, the, you know, people would get these posthumous Buddhist names, basically. Yeah.
There you go. The mystery of the names.
Yep.
And then we'll never talk about those names again.
I'll mention them again in the history section, I think. But after that, you'll never hear them again, ever.
Do you want to explain why they're called the Golden Pavilion and the Silver Pavilion?
Sure. The Golden Pavilion is called that because it's a golden pavilion. It sits on the edge of a pond, and it's actually covered in gold leaf. It's very impressive. The Silver Pavilion, however, is not silver. It's wood. It's also very beautiful in its own way, in a more natural, understated kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not silver. Do we want to spoil that now, too? Or?
Yeah, I do. It seems to have not been called the Silver Pavilion right away. It's a name that developed as time went on. One theory I've heard for this is that it just arose as a way to differentiate it from the Golden Pavilion. You know, you got your gold, you got your silver, kind of makes sense. The other theory I heard that's a little bit more interesting is that originally the Silver Pavilion was covered in a black lacquer, and it was said that on a moonlit night, the moonlight would reflect off the nearby pond and sand garden and make the building look like it was glowing in a silvery type color.
Seems like it would make sense. That sounds really pretty, too. It's not covered in black lacquer now.
No, it's not.
The other theory I saw, you know, it's really hard to tell which of these theories is most credible. They all sound kind of plausible. But I heard that it actually was supposed to be coated in silver. Like, that was part of the initial plan. But the guy that we're going to talk about that built it ran out of money. And that kind of makes sense because there was a civil war going on at the time, and those tend to be a little expensive.
Okay. I saw that in one place, but I couldn't find it in a source that looked more reputable to me, so I didn't want to bring it up.
I get it. I think I saw it in a couple places, and one made it sound like a rumor, and one said it like, this is true.
Yeah, I didn't even get like the he ran out of money part. Mm. I just got the, it was going to be covered in silver, and it didn't. And I was like, okay. Well, I need more details.
Yeah. Who knows, you know? Lost to the sands of time.
Yeah.
But they're all kind of fun, interesting theories, whichever one happens to be true.
Either way, it's a great name.
Yeah.
Makes you want to go there.
Makes them memorable. You know, you hear about the golden and silver pavilions in Kyoto. Like, well, I should go there.
Yeah.
So some other general facts about these places. Both of them are branch temples of Shokokuji, which is a Rinzai Zen Buddhist temple. Also one of the Kyoto Gozan. Five great Zen temples of Kyoto. You might remember we talked about these five great Zen temples in our episode about Tofukuji,
mm-hmm.
which is episode 98. That's another one of those five. They're basically the five head temples of this network of temples that the country's rulers used to exert their power. It's like they're using Buddhism and this whole big hierarchy of temples to influence people. Without making it obvious that they're influencing people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was something new to me. I didn't know that. I didn't know that they were both sub-temples.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And it's kind of interesting because they're a little bit all over the city. Like, none of these three temples are, like, right next to each other, right?
Mm, sure.
So, Kinkakuji is located, I'd say, like, northwest Kyoto. Definitely north quite a ways, kind of riding up to the mountains on the north side of town.
Yeah, there's this kind of natural area that kind of like extends down into the city a little bit. And Kinkakuji is kind of at the tip of this little natural pointy area, if that makes any sense.
yeah,
it's
sure.
Like a triangle that's pushing down into the north side of the city.
Yeah,
and the temple's at the tip of it. How's that? Is that better?
Yep, that makes sense.
It's in the Kita ward of Kyoto, which means the north ward.
you can get to the Golden Pavilion by a bus directly from Kyoto Station. And it takes about 40 minutes. But there's also a way where you could take a 15-minute subway line and then either a taxi or a 10-minute bus ride. And I think I'd recommend that because I've been to the Golden Pavilion and actually went on my first trip to Japan because it was one of the few things I'd really heard about at that point. I was like, yeah, Golden Pavilion, it looks beautiful. Let's go. That bus ride was one of my most miserable travel experiences in Japan. It was crowded. It was hot. It felt like it took forever. I straight up did not have a good time on that bus ride.
I remember you mentioning that before, and I totally believe you. I just want to point out that was 2008, right?
Yes.
Things might have changed a little bit since then.
True.
But I also, I mean, you know, I personally prefer trains. I would take a train to cut a bus ride short.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The train line's east, right? Like, if you go up the train line, you have to go west on the bus or
I believe
taxi.
So.
Yeah.
You could probably even walk from the train line. It might be 30 minutes or something.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me.
Right.
I do that all the time to avoid a bus or a taxi.
Right, I do it too.
It's fun to just explore the city a little bit too. You know, you get to see another part of the city that you wouldn't get to experience the same way, just zooming by in a bus. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Being on foot has a certain charm to it. But, you know, that was... what, 18 years ago? There's only so much I remember from that trip, and I remember that bus ride. I will not forget.
Yeah.
So the Silver Pavilion is along the eastern mountain range of Kyoto, and it's also a stop along that Philosopher's Path that we talked about in our Kyoto episode that we walked that was so lovely.
That was great. I would highly recommend if you're going to go to the Silver Pavilion, Ginkakuji, take the Philosopher's Path. You could either start the path at Ginkakuji and head south towards Nanzenji, or you could start the beginning of the path if you start on the south side is near Nanzenji, just north of it. And then it takes you past a bunch of temples and you're going through like this really nice wooded area, a little canal. Lots of trees, and I remember we saw stray cats and like little cafes, and it's just like a really charming area. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty great.
But otherwise, you can get there from a bus from Kyoto Station. It's about 35, 40 minutes, kind of about the same time.
One more thing about the Philosopher's Path. I just want to point out, if you want to hear more about the other things along that path, go check out episode 100, which is about Kyoto, and we talked about a day that we took just walking along that whole path and seeing all those temples was awesome.
Yeah, that was a great day.
Yep.
And then I looked it up because I was curious, because I'd never really heard of Shokokuji before, the head temple.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know where that was. And it's actually just north of the Imperial Palace area in Kyoto, which almost actually kind of makes it like right between the Golden and Silver Pavilion. But not especially close to either one.
Yeah. Well, at least it's something interesting close to the Imperial Palace. Because I feel like before when we mentioned the palace, it's like, there's not really a ton right nearby. But you can check out Shokokuji, I guess.
True. But the palace grounds are fairly extensive, too.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're talking about today.
So history, Paul.
Oh, we got some good history on this one.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting stuff. Let's start with Ginkakuji, the Golden Pavilion.
That makes sense to me.
It came first. It just makes sense chronologically, you know?
Yes. Before the Golden Pavilion was built, the land was already used as the site of a villa for the Saionji clan.
Yeah, there was this nobleman, Saionji Kintsune, which I thought was kind of a cool name.
I kept reading it as Kitsune.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's hard not to think of that when you see that. Kitsune is a fox, and Kin is gold, so I thought of it as like a portmanteau of, you know, gold and fox, like a golden fox, Kintsune. It's kind of a cool name.
Yeah, okay.
So Kintsune, the golden fox, that's what I'm going to call him. He was from a pretty important, historically significant family. But this villa that they had was relatively normal. Like, those kinds of places existed all around the edges of Kyoto. All these, you know, rich nobleman types had these little villas around the edges of Kyoto. Because they want to be, you know, in nature and stuff. And they want a place to hide out when stuff goes down in the city. But in the late 1300s, the villa was acquired by a dude. And this dude's name was Ashikaga Yoshimitsu. And this is really where the story begins, right?
Yes. He was the shogun of Japan at the time.
Can we dig into him, just like what kind of a person he was, what he was famous for?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a bit about him.
Okay.
If you would so indulge me here.
Of course, of course.
So,
I mean, can I just say, he was a really freaking big deal. Like, obviously, the shogun is a big deal, right?
Yes.
He's kind of ruling the country, but he was like a really, really big deal. He was more than just a shogun.
Yeah,
right?
I'd say he's one of the more important shoguns, one of the more important historical figures of Japan, mm-hmm. especially from this period.
Mm-hmm. If you recognize that name Ashikaga, I mean, the shogunate is named after that clan, the Ashikaga shogunate. He was the third shogun of the Ashikaga shogunate.
Yes.
Which his family had started in 1336.
He inherited the post of shogun at 9 years old upon the death of his father. And he reigned for 29 years and overcame many major problems. At the time, there was a huge schism between the North and the South. There became two imperial courts, and he eventually reunited them and brought peace back to Japan. A huge accomplishment, especially for a guy that took over at 9 years old. Like, that's pretty wild. But after dealing with all of this political stuff and accomplishing these feats, he was just done. He was ready to retire. And in 1394, he retired and abdicated in favor of his 9-year-old son. So to say he's 9 years old, he's ready. I was ready, right?
Wow.
And he was only 38 at the time. And then he took Buddhist orders and decided to reside full-time at Kinkakuji.
So he gained a reputation as a skilled negotiator, of course.
Yes, you said. Very skilled politician.
He also got super rich, making some trade deals with China. Trump would have loved him. Trade deals with China. He was also an important figure in the rise of no theater, which I thought was interesting.
Mm.
So, Paul, did you get the impression that Yoshimitsu here had a pretty high opinion of himself?
I guess I didn't come to that, but I don't know, maybe that leads into like the whole Kitayama culture itself?
I think there's a connection there, yeah. I got the impression that he just like, as I said, he was an extremely important figure. Everybody knew about him. Maybe he let it get to his head a little bit, and he wanted to make sure that everybody else had a high opinion of him, you know?
I mean, he built the Golden Pavilion.
Right. That's where this all culminates.
A little ostentatious.
Yeah. In his later years, it just seemed like he paid a lot of attention to cementing his legacy in Japanese history, right?
Yeah.
So he bought the villa from the Saionji family, and apparently, at least one of the reasons he did that was he wanted to symbolically link himself to the powerful Saionji family, because they kind of had a longer history. He's connecting himself to the past, basically.
Sure.
Also, before he died, he tried to take on the title of Daijo Tenno. Did you read that?
No.
So, until that point, that title, Daijo Tenno, had only been applied to retired emperors. And Yoshimitsu had not been an emperor.
Sure.
And then, when he died in 1408... he assumed another name, Roku-Onin. So remember, I'm going to say the actual name of this temple again that we said we weren't going to say again. Roku-Onji is the official name of the Temple of the Golden Pavilion. After Yoshimitsu died, he named himself Roku-Onin. That was his posthumous name. And then he had the villa turned into a temple called Roku-Onji. So he's basically saying like, okay, this temple is for me. This is my temple. Oh, and by the way, it's covered in gold.
Yeah.
Which no temple has ever been before, apparently, as far as I know.
Yeah, or since, as far as I know.
Like, that takes some pride to, like, create a temple and then name it after yourself.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Well, he was the Shogun.
True. But it just shows like, okay, one, he's got the money to cover a pavilion in gold. He's just showing everybody, hey, I'm freaking rich. But two, this gold is also supposed to symbolize purity and immortality. This is kind of his way to attain immortality through this temple.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also probably pretty heavily influenced by the Chinese aesthetics of the time. And this ties into the culture that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I mentioned the Kitayama culture,
yeah,
which the Golden Pavilion became the center of. And it was heavily influenced by Chinese culture, because you mentioned all the trade deals he had.
Yeah, he had gotten pretty close with China while he was alive. Apparently, actually, so close that at some point they started calling him the King of Japan.
Okay. He collected a large number of Chinese cultural artifacts that he kept at the Golden Pavilion, but the Kitayama culture never really went beyond the top aristocrats. I think partly because it was so expensive and ostentatious. It never really filtered down to everyday Japanese society.
Yeah, the impression I get is like that the character of the Chinese culture that he was into, that he kind of brought over to Japan, was really into like shiny metals and aristocratic stuff. You know, normal people aren't going to have access to any of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's the Golden Pavilion.
Yep.
Now let's talk about another Ashikaga, Yoshimasa. This is Yoshimitsu's grandson. So same shogunate, same family. We're just talking about two generations after. And Yoshimasa was the eighth shogun of the shogunate. And you might think, well, wait a minute. There's a grandfather and then his son and then his son. Shouldn't he just be two shoguns after the first guy? Well, no, because they're, you know, there are siblings and all the, there's the whole line of succession, right? There were more people involved.
I don't have the whole list, but I did see that Yoshimasa's father was famous for his violent temper and nobody liked him. And he didn't last too long on the throne.
I got some details on him, too. Okay. I thought that was really actually funny to read about.
Okay. But, enlighten us, please.
Okay, so, well, just for context, Yoshimasa, the grandson of Yoshimitsu, who created the Golden Pavilion, he never actually knew his grandfather. They weren't alive at the same time. Yoshimitsu had already been dead almost 30 years by the time Yoshimasa was even born. Okay, so Yoshimasa's dad, the guy in between them, Yoshinori, yeah, I read that he was a super harsh guy, had a violent temper. He was very quick to punish anyone who bothered him in any way. He actually earned the nickname the Evil Shogun.
I saw that.
That's great.
Oh, man.
People freaking hated him to the point that he died because he was assassinated by his own general in 1441.
Yeah.
You got to be a real dick to be murdered by your own general. Right? I don't know. I mean, all sorts of political stuff happens, I guess. I'm sure that happened before.
I didn't see the full story, but I thought it was interesting that that general didn't seize power. Like, the son took over.
Yeah, the general's just like, I don't even want the power. I just really want this guy out of here.
Yoshimasa's older brother became the shogun at that point.
It's probably not historically accurate. I just like imagining this guy walking around just like being a total a-hole to everyone and everybody just sitting around like, I can't wait for this guy to die.
This one guy's like, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And then he kills him and everyone's like, eh, I'm not mad about that.
Yeah.
Anyways, were you going somewhere there? Did I cut you off?
Oh, you're good. Oh, well, I was going to say, so after Yoshimasa's dad died, there was another heir. Oh, wait, you mentioned him, right?
His brother.
The brother, yeah.
Yeah.
But then he died just a couple years after taking power because he fell off a horse.
Age-old way of kings dying, falling off a horse.
It seemed like that happened a lot, right?
Yeah.
Well, although sometimes it wasn't really clear if...
Right.
Maybe they fell off a horse onto a sword.
He was out hunting and he fell off a horse.
Yeah, exactly. But, okay, so then, after the brother's dead, Yoshimasa, he was appointed shogun at age...
15.
Yes. 1449. Can you imagine?
Hey, at least he made it past 9. 15 is a little more reasonable.
Yeah, that's commendable. Yeah.
But Yoshimasa was not a great politician and not a great shogun.
No, but he did see the rise of what's known as Higashiyama culture. So his grandfather, he was in the north, Kitayama culture, and now Yoshimasa in the east, he's got Higashiyama culture.
Oh, I totally missed that somehow. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, no problem. It's just north mountains and east mountains, basically. Kind of like, you know, it's funny, like, you got the golden pavilion, the silver pavilion, those two things that contrast, and then you got the northern mountain culture and the eastern mountain culture. It's just,
yeah,
same kind of thing there.
Yoshimasa was a huge lover of the arts, and under the Higashiyama culture, much of what we know of as traditional Japanese culture today really started forming. Like, the roots of garden design started around then, and flower arrangements, architectural themes that continue to this day.
Sumie paintings, no theater. Like, his grandfather started, or I don't know, was involved in supporting no theater, but I think Yoshimasa kind of guided it along towards what it is today, you know?
I thought this was so interesting because I struggle saying both of their names next to each other. Yoshimitsu was like a good politician and a good shogun, but was like, his art didn't really trickle down into Japanese society. And then Yoshimasa was a terrible shogun, but his contributions to art helped shape Japanese society for all people.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of an interesting, like, juxtaposition between the two.
It is. It is interesting. Yeah, so this Higashiyama culture, similar to the Kitayama culture, they're both kind of based on these Zen Buddhist ideals, but I think Yoshimasa focused more on things like wabi-sabi, which is like the impermanence of things and the appreciation of imperfection. You know, I get the impression that Yoshimasa with the golden pavilion, like you said, it's all ostentatious
stuff. Doesn't seem like imperfection there.
Right, right. Yeah. Yoshimasa valued the much more like natural aesthetic, not so ostentatious, and making it more accessible to everyone, I guess.
Yeah.
That type of art where it's like, it's not about the money that you're spending on this stuff. It's not about trying to be fancier than everybody. It's about appreciating the beauty in everyday things.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Just spending money itself isn't artistic.
Yeah, yeah. So while Yoshimasa was focusing on his art stuff,
the country fell apart, right?
Well, his mom and father-in-law, they were basically the ones that were meddling in politics and taking care of things. And that's part of what contributed to the social unrest and the dissolution of order, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Farmers started revolting due to high taxes. And Yoshimasa just, he wasn't well equipped to keep things under control.
Yeah.
And if that wasn't enough, he basically is kind of directly responsible for starting the civil war that caused like the 250 years of violence now known as the Warring States period. Like, it's kind of his fault, and not just like letting things kind of fall apart slowly. He kind of did one single thing that started this whole disaster.
How do you do that?
It's hilarious, man. Well, now that we're looking back hundreds of years at this, it's hilarious. But at the time,
it was pretty dumb at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Yoshimasa didn't have an heir. He was too busy with his art, I guess. So to avoid leaving a power vacuum, like, we all know that's bad. If you don't have an heir and then you die or something, that's going to cause a civil war. So he thought, well, I'll just adopt my younger brother as my heir, and then I don't have to worry about making babies. It'll be great. Then I can focus on my flower arranging, and everything will be fine.
Then he made a fatal mistake. He made a baby.
He did. He did make a baby the very next year.
Yeah, like immediately.
So then you got these two factions. One thinks, well, the brother is the heir because he said he was the heir because he adopted him.
Yeah.
And then the other faction is like, well, now he has a legitimate biological baby, and that one's the heir.
It seemed like his wife was really pushing, like, no, our baby needs to be the heir.
It's always the baby's mama that's like,
right. Which, you know, take it with a grain of salt, because women in history sometimes get written as the scapegoats.
Sure. But yeah, so you got two factions supporting two different candidates for shogun. That's how you start a civil war.
Right.
That war was called the Onin War. And like I said, it started the Sengoku period, during which the Kinkakuji complex that his grandpa had built, remember, was burned down. Everything but the temple itself was burned down.
The Onin War was terrible for Kyoto. Almost the whole city got destroyed multiple times. They were digging trenches along roads in the middle of the city and just constant fighting. It was a disaster.
Yep. Pretty bad.
But, you know, Yoshimasa was retired, hanging out in his silver pavilion.
Yeah.
Doing like, art
I got
and
a
stuff.
Villa. I got a retirement villa on the edge of the city. I don't need to get involved in that stuff. Oh, and that's another interesting thing that I learned in this research is that when we talk about these retired shoguns and stuff, sometimes that was a political move to save their own skin. Because, like, they wouldn't just be retired shoguns. They would say, okay, I'm retiring from being shogun, and now I'm a monk. That's why all these, you know, villas turned into temples, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't kill a Buddhist monk. That's bad juju.
And I think depending on each one, a lot of them retired to get themselves out of the daily grind of court life, but they still wielded a lot of power and influence behind the scenes, but they would step in when they wanted to.
Hmm.
Yoshimasa, maybe not as much. I don't think he wanted to be involved.
Probably not. So even after that, I mean, we're in the Warring States period now. People are dying all over, but he's like, I want a pavilion, man.
Yep.
So he built the Silver Pavilion in 1482 on the site of his brother's old residence, actually.
Okay.
The one that he adopted. And he specifically modeled his Silver Pavilion after the Golden Pavilion that his grandpa made. And they have a lot of similarities, don't they, Paul?
They do.
I mean, we already said both of them started as retirement villas. They're both temples to Kanon, goddess of mercy. Both were turned into temples after their owner's death and then named after their owner's posthumous name. And that's why we're talking about both of them in the same episode. You got a golden pavilion, you got a silver pavilion. Boom. All right, so skipping ahead a bit, let's get to the end of the Warring States period now. We're getting close to the unification.
Unification.
That's the word I was looking for. Unification of Japan. Oda Nobunaga, one of the three great unifiers. I learned that he took these famous stones from the garden at Ginkakuji, the silver pavilion. He used them at Nijo Castle when he built that. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, that's cool.
And for a long time, Ginkakuji, silver pavilion, was just left to rot in that time period. But then it was restored at the beginning of the Edo period and redesigned in a style considered more suitable for a Zen temple. So it doesn't quite look now like it did when it was originally built.
Sure. Speaking of the three unifiers, I found an interesting note that there was a priest named Saisho Shotai, who was a top advisor to both Toyotomi Hideyoshi and later Tokugawa Ieyasu. And he was actually appointed the head abbot of the Golden Pavilion. And he started the whole trope that I've still seen in anime to this day of the black-robed prime minister. Because he wore black robes as a monk.
You've seen this in anime?
Yeah.
Where? Like,
I've seen it at least recently. I can't remember the name. It was in like a world-building isekai where this modern-day guy gets transferred back and becomes king.
Hmm.
And he appoints a black-robed prime minister who's super intelligent and helps him like turn the country around. Next I got is the burning in 1950.
Yeah. How much did you dig into that?
A bit.
Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. So in 1950, a novice monk set the Golden Pavilion on fire. He burned down a large portion of the temple. Okay, Paul, researching this part, I had trouble getting to the truth of the situation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I left a bit out because it seemed like hearsay or one source said this and the other source completely said it wasn't true.
Yeah, it seemed very
like motives were put on this guy that maybe weren't really motives.
Exactly.
And I left that stuff out.
Okay. I think there are a few factors going into why it's hard to get to the truth of the situation. One is that, I mean, it happened a long time ago. It happened like 75 years ago in a country on the other side of the world, which at the time was still like very foreign and exotic, and not a lot of information got to the U.S.
or still got to the English language. World War II.
Yep. Another thing is that it probably involved mental health issues, and people didn't know a lot about them maybe at the time. We still don't know a ton about, you know, some of that kind of stuff. And so it's hard to know, like, what his motivations were and how exactly it went down. And also, there's a novel, a famous novel, based on this incident. And I think a lot of things that I read seem to take things from that novel and say them as if they're true, but it's a fictional novel that's based on this thing that actually happened. So,
yeah.
And then people try to assign all of these, like, you know, deeper meaning to this thing that might not necessarily be true. It's just they're trying to make it poetic or something,
right,
or trying to make it into a bigger thing.
Right. To me, it just seemed like a mentally disturbed individual did something awful. Who knows why?
Yeah.
Right?
So maybe he had schizophrenia. It's unclear. There are a lot of things that are unclear about this.
Yeah. Well, should we get into the details a little
bit? Yeah, give us some facts. What do you know, or what are you pretty confident about?
So, the novice monk who burned down the temple was named Hayashi Yoken. He was 22 years old at the time. I found some interesting things about his life. He was clearly a troubled individual. He was enrolled in college at the time, but had the worst grades in the entire school. He would spend his time playing the board game Go rather than studying, even though he was warned by the head priest many times that he needed to work on his school more. He had been caught cheating on exams. He turned in blank papers for assignments. He apparently would randomly grab people and throw them in the temple and then claim it was judo practice.
Yeah, that's a weird detail.
Shortly before he burned down the pavilion, he sold some of his possessions and spent a couple days apparently on a bender in the red light district.
I heard something about that.
And then he bought 100 tablets of Bromisoval, a sedative that he would later use. That's kind of the background I have on this individual.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've got anything to add.
No, that was pretty good.
So then the incident itself. I actually saw that the fire alarm was out of service at the time, and it was scheduled to get fixed the day he burned it down.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Which is crazy. So at about 3 a.m. on July 2nd, 1950, Hayashi snuck into the Golden Pavilion, stacked a bunch of his belongings on top of the offering box, and set it on fire.
It is kind of interesting that he chose to use his own belongings, you know, to set the fire, and that he put, kind of brought them into this sacred place. And like it,
right,
that part of it does make it sound like he was trying to make some sort of statement, but it's
or he was just suffering and was trying to like release something from himself. There's a lot there probably for some psychologists to unpack.
Right. Or, you know, it could have just been totally illogical. You know, schizophrenia
or he's like,
type thinking.
I need something
thinking.
That burns, and he just grabbed his stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw, you know, when I talked about people trying to assign greater meaning to it, like I saw people saying, oh, his motivation was he was jealous of the Golden Pavilion's beauty, or he hated beauty, or the upper class. Like, they turn it into a social commentary sort of thing.
I saw that too, but I didn't see any sources like saying that he was particularly ugly or anything. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
That seemed like maybe a stretch.
Yeah.
Almost the entire building burned down, even though the fire was spotted pretty quickly.
It just went up super, super fast.
It was just too late.
Like, in minutes, the thing was engulfed in flames.
The whole roof collapsed. It was just a shell. I think I saw a picture. There was like a shell of just a few beams left standing in the walls.
I mean, you know, temples from back then, they're all wood. They were very susceptible.
Right, no sprinklers or anything.
Yep.
They found him out real quick. The police found his somewhat burned belongings as the starter of the fire and immediately identified him. And they ended up finding him out in the mountains nearby, attempting suicide. He had consumed all of the sedative tablets that he bought and also stabbed himself in the chest.
It's intense, man.
But he survived.
Yeah.
Did you hear about his mother?
Yeah, very sad.
This was the wildest part for me. So on the day after this, upon hearing about her son doing this, his mother killed herself by jumping into a river from a moving train.
I didn't realize it was the very next day.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. Well, he burned it down at like 3 a.m. on July 2nd, and she killed herself on July 3rd. So it was like a day and a half later, maybe. She apparently had said at the police station after learning about what her son did, "My son is a traitor to the nation. Why couldn't he die after doing such an act? How can I pay for such a crime? This crime cannot be compared to any other crimes. If I can die instead of him to pay for his sins, I'll gladly do so." Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. I mean, I don't think she should have killed herself, but I totally get where, like, your family member, like, burns down this incredibly irreplaceable, beautiful national treasure building. Like, that'd be tough.
Yeah, for sure. Especially, like, in the moment, you know?
Yeah.
Just thinking about, like, everyone in the country is going to hear about this. And, it, you know, there's the whole traditional idea of, like, the honor of your family and stuff. Yeah. It's like, our family is done.
She didn't want to live with everybody knowing that her son did that. Yeah,
just the most intense shame imaginable. Almost.
I didn't really find anything about his childhood, but I imagine he was probably giving her problems for a long time.
It's not like he was giving a lot of people problems.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right. So, I mean, Hayashi did survive his suicide attempt, but he didn't do well after that. He admitted to his crime and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And he was actually released early for medical reasons and died of tuberculosis in 1956, only 6 years after he burned down the pavilion. The reconstruction of the pavilion was actually finished in 1955, only 5 years later. And a really interesting note on that is that the Golden Pavilion had been modified over the centuries. And when they rebuilt it as close as they could to the original specifications.
Okay. What I saw was that they made the gold coating sturdier because it had been like flaking off in the past. They had a bunch of problems with it flaking off because it's so thin, right? Gold leaf. So they actually made the gold leaf 5 times thicker this time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And like I said, I haven't been here, but just looking more closely at the pictures when I was researching this, it's incredible.
Like, the gold is stunning.
And it covers every single inch. Like, you look, you know, you zoom in on these pictures, and it's like, there's nothing here that's not gold.
Yeah, it's the real deal.
It's crazy.
The last note I have is that there was extensive renovations in 1987, and the gold leaf was reapplied again at that point.
Okay. I just wanted to mention, I already mentioned that novel. Famous novel that was written about this incident. That was by author Yukio Mishima. And there are also multiple film adaptations of that book. So
The
story really like took on a life of its own, captured the imagination.
Yeah, a whole movie about the Golden Pavilion being burned out.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I can see how myth is getting intertwined as there's movies and books and all this stuff.
Exactly. It becomes less and less clear what the truth of the situation was.
Right.
In 1994, the Golden Pavilion was designated a World Heritage Site. And then the Silver Pavilion, Ginkaku-ji, was refurbished in 2008. And I actually saw, Paul, maybe this confirms the idea that it was originally supposed to have silver. Or maybe this is another rumor. I guess that's possible too. But I saw that they actually considered putting silver on it this time when they refurbished it in 2008.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but they decided to leave it just plain wood.
Okay.
Which, if this is true, and I don't know. For some reason, this seemed more credible to me, but I think that's the right choice, leaving it wood. Like,
I agree.
Even if it was originally intended to have silver.
After 500 years, yeah, you're going to put silver on it for the first time. Yeah. I don't know about that.
I want to see it the way that the creator created it.
Yeah.
Although, didn't I already say that they kind of made it more appropriate for a Zen temple or something? So it really isn't quite
that
way.
That was
anyway.
Hundreds of years ago, too.
True. Yeah. It's still really old and pretty if you see it now. Like, yes. It's worth seeing.
Yes. So now let's go visit these places. We'll start with Kitakakuji, the Golden Pavilion. What are you going to see and experience as you visit this temple?
Well, I'll tell you, Paul. First, you're going to walk through a main gate.
Sounds like a good start.
Yep. And then you're going to pass a bell. Did you see the bell?
Not that I recall.
There's a bell there that was supposedly commissioned by the Saionji family. It's one of the things that goes, you know, dates back all the way to that family before it became the Golden Pavilion.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So I think this is maybe a good time to mention that when I visited here, I didn't know anything about this place other than beautiful golden building.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't done my research. We've talked about this before, like regretting not knowing the places.
Yeah, totally.
I literally remember the pavilion and how beautiful it was and the pond. I don't remember anything else about the whole facility. Because I didn't know what it was. It didn't mean anything to me.
Yep. I feel that way about a lot of things that we cover. And it makes me sad, you know, that I didn't fully appreciate it when I was there. It also, you know, I think it just reinforces a point that we've brought up again and again and again on the podcast, which is like just knowing something about these places you're going to visit enriches the experience so much. You're just going to appreciate it more. It's more interesting looking at these things when you know the story behind them.
Yeah.
And
hey, thanks for leading me into a shameless plug. We've written some itineraries that are available on our Patreon, and we give some context about why these places are amazing and all the cool things that you should look out for when you visit them.
That's a great plug, Paul. Yeah, go check out our Patreon. We have 6 itineraries now, and they all are awesome, if I do say so myself.
You know how we deep dive. We deep dove and found some cool stuff, I think.
Yeah. You know, Paul, I'm reminded of a video I saw, a reel on Instagram that kind of, it bugged me. And it shouldn't bug me, but it bugged me.
Call them out, Jason.
Okay, so there are these people, and they went to Osaka Castle, which admittedly, not an original castle, right?
Yeah, but still beautiful and a nice museum.
It's beautiful, and there is, like, interesting stuff inside. Yeah, like you said, the museum is, you know, all the history and stuff. If you know the story, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But they made this reel. It's one of those things where they're like, POV visiting Osaka Castle. And it shows them walking up and looking at it. And they're like, okay, we can go. And they just turn around and walk away.
It's
like,
oh, no.
Oh, you guys. No. Like, that's not how you visit Japan. You know, if you're doing a Japan trip like that, in my opinion, you're doing it all wrong.
Yeah. I feel like it's really been trending lately in the Japan travel, like, is it worth it or not type of thing, which we've dived into a little bit too, but I feel like try to go a little deeper, but I feel like, yeah, you get a lot of that. Like,
I think,
should you go here? Is it worth it? You know,
as we know, tourism in Japan has exploded the last decade or so, but I bet 90-something% of people that visit approach it like that. You know, they see a thing, they're like, oh, that's pretty. I know nothing about it. I know no history here or anything. It's pretty. Okay, now let's go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And like, it just makes me so sad.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to shame those people that approach, you know, a trip that way.
Yeah, that's
fine. Like,
if
you just want to see pretty things.
I mean, it's kind of how I did my first trip.
Yeah, same.
You know? And I enjoyed it. It was a great experience.
Yeah.
But there's more out there.
It makes me sad.
If you spend the time and energy.
Yeah.
But you know what? To give ourselves a pat on the back, I think we've created a nice little community with our listeners here. Like, if you're listening to us talk for an hour and a half about one specific subject, you probably, like, really care to learn about what you're going to see in Japan, and you're really interested in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy that we kind of have a place here where we can really dive into stuff, and we have people that listen and care.
Me too.
It's always surprised me how many people like us, listen to us.
It surprises us how many people like us. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I remember when we started and it's like, we're diving so deep into this stuff. Does anyone care about this?
Right? And we go deeper now probably than we did when we started.
Well, Paul, you're going to be blown away by how deep my very next sentence in my notes is.
Yeah, what do? We just passed the bell?
We're talking about the bell. I got one more thing about the bell. Okay. So I'm a music nerd. I went to school for music and stuff. And if there are any other music nerds listening, you may be interested to know that this bell rings with A as its bass tone. And the overtones, get this, you guys, are in the Dorian mode. Isn't that cool?
I remember reading this and being like, okay. I'm not surprised at all that you thought it was cool.
Well, the music nerds out there are going to think that's pretty cool.
I'm just not educated enough to really understand what that means.
Well, the Dorian mode, it involves certain notes that aren't like the... You've heard of the major scale, right? And the minor scale?
Yes.
The Dorian mode is kind of like another scale. You can think of it that way.
Okay. I learned something
It's
today.
Just like
Thanks,
a collection
Jason.
Of notes.
Okay.
It's interesting, trust me.
Okay.
So there are other buildings to see too, right?
Yeah. Like, you pass by quite a few other buildings kind of on the way to the Pond and Pavilion.
Yeah. I remember always hearing, oh, you know, you go to the Golden Pavilion and that's really all there is. It's just the pavilion to look at. But that's like those people that went to Osaka Castle and then turned right around. They just didn't have their eyes open. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are other buildings around. Most of them, though, were built a bit later than the pavilion itself.
They do show off some nice characteristics of Zen temple architecture. Yeah.
They were rearranged at the beginning of the Edo period, too, I saw.
That happens
things,
a lot.
You know, things get moved around.
Yeah. There's also at least one really impressive tree. I don't know if you saw this, but I don't know if I'm saying this right. I don't know if I've ever heard of this before, but Quercus gilva beech tree. It's Quercus. And they're very old, and they were actually, all of these trees in Kyoto were designated as like a collective national monument.
Huh.
And there's at least, I saw one picture of at least one really big, old, cool looking one on the temple grounds here.
Well, now I'm curious to see it just because of that designation as a natural monument.
If you go to the Kinkakuji website, they've got a picture of it.
That's cool. That's before you get to the pavilion?
Yes.
Right? Okay. Another thing I saw before you get there is a little stone memorial tower. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It memorializes a Tendai Buddhist monk named Jozo, who lived in the early 900s.
Man,
going way back.
Ancient. All these sites in Kyoto are so old.
Yeah, but I love the story of this guy's life. Like, they're very little details, of course. And it's, I mean, who knows how factual it is. Maybe it's a myth or whatever. But I read that he was wise in childhood. An old soul, perhaps, you know. He set his sights on Buddhism at age 7. And he had entered the priesthood by age 12. 12-year-old priest. Isn't that crazy? He was apparently also really good at faith healing and exorcisms.
I saw that.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
He's also known for performing miracles. So these days, if you visit this tower, you can still get a wish granted by him. Isn't that
nice.
Fun?
That's awesome.
Yeah. Little kid priest.
Well, back before school, you had to start working.
I guess.
You got anything else before the pavilion?
No, let's get to the pond.
Yeah. So eventually you get to the spot where you turn a corner and the pond opens up before you. And it's a really large pond. It's got multiple islands on it. It's got some rock formations. It's got little pine trees on the island. Think of just a beautiful Japanese garden, a big pond. And then right up on the edge of it is the Golden Pavilion, shimmering golden in the sun. It is truly gorgeous.
Let's not give people unrealistic expectations, Paul. It could be raining, and then it won't be in the beautiful sunlight.
Thinking best case scenario here.
Maybe it's the middle of a thunderstorm.
It was gorgeous when I went. It was hot.
It just has like this magical
little bubble.
Magical little bubble of perfect weather around it.
Yeah. It'd probably look okay in the rain too.
I bet it looks good in all situations.
So the pavilion itself is 3 floors. The first floor is built in the Shinden style that was used for palace buildings during the Heian period. And it's not coated in gold.
Yeah, that first tier is the only one that's not gold.
It's white plaster walls, but the white color kind of helps the gold pop maybe a little bit.
I feel like you almost don't even notice it because your eyes are so drawn to the gold.
True, true. And the second floor was built in the buke style, which was used in samurai residences. And
in the Kamakura period. We're talking about like different architectural styles in different time periods.
Yeah, which makes the building really unique in that way too.
Mm-hmm.
And that floor is entirely wrapped on the outside in the gold leaf. Then there is the third floor that was built in the style of a Chinese Zen hall. And I didn't know this, but it's gilded inside and outside.
Huh.
I actually saw a picture of the inside, and it's stunning.
Oh, I didn't know you were even allowed to see the inside.
Only if you go to their official website. Some monk took a picture.
That's cool.
And then the very top of the building is capped with a golden phoenix statue.
That's a lucky symbol in China and not uncommon for this Chinese style of architecture, you know, for the top tier there. You know, we've seen another place, Paul, that has golden phoenixes on top.
The Phoenix Hall?
Yep, at Byodoin.
Yeah, that's a really impressive building in its own right.
Definitely.
In a different way.
Yes. I also want to point out that the Golden Pavilion is a reliquary hall, meaning that it contains holy relics.
Yes.
And I got a little more information about the area around the pavilion, like the pond and stuff.
Okay.
So it's right in the middle of this 92,400 square meter garden.
It's huge.
Yeah. And the pond there is called Kyokochi Pond. And like you said, it's got all those little islands in there. There's one kind of, the biggest island's got a little tree on it too, right?
Yep.
Looks cool. And I'm pretty sure these islands and stones coming up out of the water are symbolic too. A lot of temples have like ponds with stones representing these like sacred islands from mythology.
Sure, yeah. Speaking of the pond, on the backside of the pavilion, there's a little dock area that they used to use to go out in a boat
and
then row around the pond on.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Got all sorts of different views from out there.
And here's another odd thing that's probably just my mind playing tricks on me because it's been so long, but I could swear that I walked around the entire pond, but everything I see today, all the maps, all the videos I saw on YouTube, you can only walk around like half the pond.
Like so, the right or the east side of it, right?
Yeah. So maybe that's changed the last 18 years. It's probably just my memory being dumb, but I really thought I walked around the whole thing, and because I feel like I remember seeing it from all these different angles.
Hmm.
But I couldn't figure that one out in my research.
Yeah, I don't know.
But now you can walk around. You kind of start on the far side, kind of like almost, not quite, but almost directly across the pond, yep. And then you walk around the east side till you're right up next to the Golden Pavilion.
Yep, that's what I got from the maps I found.
Yeah.
But there's still more to see, even past the pavilion, right, Paul?
Apparently. I don't remember, but apparently, yes. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, these are the kinds of things that you might not pay a lot of attention to unless you know what they're about and why they're important. So, did you read about Ginga Sen or the Milky Way Spring?
Yes. It was said to be where Yoshimitsu got his water for his tea.
And then there's also a stream near that where he's said to have washed his hands.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
There's also a 2.3 meter waterfall on the grounds that's, I guess, topped with a carp stone. And I thought this was interesting because we got another Pokemon reference here, I think. The carp stone is apparently in reference to an ancient Chinese legend where a carp scaled a waterfall and transformed into a dragon.
Wow.
Magikarp?
Yeah.
Anyone? Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't read that. I just read that this stone had carved into it the Japanese characters for Magikarp.
Okay. Well, there we go.
I made that up.
Yeah, I can't make stuff up. I believed you.
Magikarp, I don't think is a traditional, you know, old Japanese word.
Yeah. Now that I think about that, I'm really dumb for believing you. what else we got in the area, Jason?
Well, further back from the main pond, there's another pond known as Anmintaku or Ushitaku or Bontaku.
I saw
it. It has different names for some reason, but they say that it never dries up even during droughts and was historically used as a place to pray for rain.
Gotta make sense.
That was interesting. And another cool feature of this pond is that there's a little island in the middle of it with a little stone pagoda on it. And that stone pagoda is said to enshrine the Sionji family deity. Remember that Sionji family? They were the first ones to own this a villa here.
Yep.
And so that's another remnant from even further back than the guy that built the pavilion, the golden pavilion.
I love those little tie-ins.
Yeah, yeah.
To the even further back history.
Me too.
Well, then if you continue on, there is also a tea house that was added on during the Edo period. And it is supposed to be a really great place to view the setting sun over the Golden Pavilion. Because it's kind of up on a hill a little bit, I think.
The tea house is named Sekate, which means evening sun stop.
Well, there we go.
So you stop there, you watch the evening sun. Yeah, I mean, if you can time it right, like I would love to see the Golden Pavilion from there with the sunset. Like, man.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty great. And the tea house itself is really pretty too. It's got like very natural looking with moss on the thatch roof and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think that's our Kinkakuji experience.
I think that's it.
So now we're going to visit Ginkaku-ji.
That's the silver one.
Thank you.
No problem.
I said it right. I'm happy.
You got it.
So the entrance here is kind of cool because right when you pass through the main gate, there's a 50 meter long pathway that's lined with bamboo fences and trees. That's kind of a quiet area that lets you disconnect from the busy city outside and kind of ready yourself to get to this Zen temple.
I remember that pretty clearly. Like it's kind of, you notice that the vibe has changed.
Yeah.
You're like in this sort of, it's almost like a liminal space. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It was nice. We were deep into our philosopher's path day. We'd seen a bunch of temples. Like, it was nice.
It is nice. Once you get to the end of that pathway, you're going to pass through the reception area, get your tickets. Kind of brings you back to the real world a little bit.
Oh, no, I got to pay.
Yeah. And then it kind of opens up in front of you. Like, you're going to see various buildings. It's not as much of like a single path that you're following that brings you to these different things. It's just kind of all laid out there in front of you. The reception hall has some really amazing art. They have fusuma, which are like those painted screens, like movable wall sections.
Yep.
Painted by famous calligrapher Tomioka Tessai. And they have international paintings from the Meiji era, I saw.
There's a building called Togudo, which is, besides the silver pavilion itself, the only building that dates back to the temple's founding. And this building is really famous because it's said to be the first ever example of a tatami room that's 4.5 mats, which has become the standard for all tatami rooms today.
Wow, I didn't see that. It's interesting.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't go inside.
That's because it's a sacred place, Paul.
Yeah.
This building is where Amida Nyorai is enshrined, and it was built as a symbol of faith in Pure Land Buddhism. Another notable building is the main hall, which was constructed in the Edo period. Not all the buildings go way, way back. You know, this is much more recent.
Yeah, only 300 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's still pretty old. But it's real beautiful, lots of natural wood. Buddha is enshrined there. And it also has a lot of amazing art inside. You ready to talk about the sand, Paul?
Yeah.
All right.
I was impressed with the sand.
Yeah, it's definitely noticeable.
So there's a expansive white sand garden that's known as Ginshadan. or the Sea of Silver?
So the Sea of Silver Sand, specifically.
Oh, thank you.
And there are kind of these stripes in the sand that look kind of like stairs. I think that's the idea behind
okay.
it.
Okay.
So the Gin Sha Dan is that kind of flat area. And then there's also this big cone, or it looks like a big cone if you chopped the top of the cone off.
Yeah. But it's like, what, like 5 feet high?
It's big.
A big cone of sand.
Yeah, it's made of the same sand, the white sand. And that thing is called the Kogetsudai, or moon viewing platform. And I don't know. This is one of those things where it's like there's this kind of story attached to it that doesn't make a whole ton of sense.
Yeah.
So I heard that the Gin Sha Dan, the stairs kind of thing, the flat part, reflects the moonlight. And then the Kogetsudai, the cone with the top chopped off, is supposed to look like it's holding the moon. And I think I even remember reading that when we were there, you know, that, oh, the moon sits on top of this thing. But then you look at it and you're like, that makes no sense. Like, how could the moon, like, what position would I even need to be in for the moon to look like it was sitting on top of this thing? I'd need to be, like, laying on the ground, looking up at it or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But we weren't there at night either, so.
True, but, like, I don't know.
Also, the entire sand garden slants slightly towards the Silver Pavilion. Because I think I mentioned one of the theories about the Silver Pavilion is the moonlight reflecting off. So it's kind of like, it is slightly angled towards the pavilion to give a tiny bit of credence to that theory.
Okay. Another thing I saw about the cone, it might be modeled after Mount Fuji.
I feel like I remember hearing that when we were there.
And it kind of makes sense because there are a lot of other places around Japan where there's like a little mountain kind of in the shape of Mount Fuji that looks very similar to this thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, like a man-made mountain or just a pile of stones or something. Like,
yeah.
All around the country, there are these places where they're like, oh, this is a mini Mount Fuji that
yeah.
we made.
Well, Fuji's very sacred.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah.
So there's also an extensive garden area.
Yeah. You know, I love the moss gardens.
Yes.
And there's a lot of moss here.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. Actually, apparently, so there's a temple in Kyoto called Saihoji, also known as Kokedera, also known as the Moss Temple.
Yes.
Apparently that was a source of inspiration for Yoshimasa when he first built the Silver Pavilion.
Okay.
And that kind of makes sense because there's a whole lot of moss
yeah.
at Ginkakuji.
Yeah, there's some ponds, some bridges, a little stream, kind of, you know, your Japanese garden stuff.
I saw this is the only surviving garden whose design was overseen by Yoshimasa himself.
Okay, that's cool.
Yep.
The path through the garden eventually climbs up a hill behind or away from everything that kind of gives you an overlook of the entire temple grounds and even a bit of the city itself as well.
Yeah.
Which I don't remember. I don't know if we made it that far or not.
We might not have gone up that path. I think I'd been there before you and I went.
Oh, okay.
I think I might have gone up there the first time.
Okay.
But yeah.
I could just be forgetting too. Well, so as we wind our way back down, we're going to pass right past the Silver Pavilion itself.
Which is also on the edge of a little pond, kind of like Kinkakuji, but the pond is much smaller.
Yeah, but still beautiful.
Very pretty, yeah. So the walls of the pavilion are a natural wood color, not silver. There's white paper on the sliding screens. It's very pretty. Like, I just like the way that it kind of harmonizes with the pond, and like I remember flowers and stuff lining the pond. It's just a very like it unlike Kinkakuji, which really stands out, like it really grabs your attention. Ginkakuji harmonizes with nature much more, I think, which makes a lot of sense with that Higashiyama culture that yeah. we talked about.
I think that's a great way to put it. It kind of fits in with everything. It doesn't just stand out like all on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also topped with a phoenix that I saw was bronze, but I think it's painted silver from what I saw in the pictures.
I didn't realize that. I don't know how I missed that.
You're welcome.
Another similarity between the two.
They are connected in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mentioned that Ginkakuji is also a temple to Kanon, like the other. The building is formally named the Kanon Den, actually.
Mm.
And Yoshimasa named the first floor the Shinkuden, which means empty mind hall, And then the second floor is the Chonkaku, the Wave Sound Pavilion, which are really cool names, I think.
Yeah.
Sounds a little bit like hippy-dippy new wave kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, to completely derail here, you were showing me on the TV earlier the, like, when you played the music.
Yeah.
What's that called?
It was a visualizer kind of thing called Electric Sheep.
Yeah. But when you were showing that, like, it almost looked like some Buddhist art to me. And it got me thinking, like, Buddhist art does kind of, like, pass over into, like, the trippy type stuff sometimes.
Hmm. I hadn't really thought of that. What kind of Buddhist art are you thinking of specifically, if I may ask?
I mean, I couldn't give you any names or anything, but...
Can you describe?
Like, a lot of colors and shapes. Like, maybe off the top of my head, like, the Tibetan, I think, Buddhists that make, like, the sand...
Okay.
Things,
okay.
You know, sure, and sure, it's sure. All colors and shapes intertwining
I
and stuff.
See, I see.
That's kind of what I was talking about.
Lots of patterns and kind of, I mean, the thing that you're talking about that I was showing on the TV, lots of like fractal based stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Patterns and repeating things, different sizes and whatever.
Yep.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
I'm done. That's all I got.
Okay. Last thing I have is be sure to check out the gift shop on the way out.
Sure.
Pretty cool gift shop. I think I got a Froshki or something there.
Okay. I don't think I got anything. Regrets.
All right. Well, there you go. Two pavilions. Now, I hope it makes sense why we talked about both of them in the same episode. A lot tying them together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we go, we should thank our Shogun level patrons. Kevin Harris, Michael Morris, Brady K, Jack, Tori, Shaked Rosenthal, Pamela Arola, Kevin Phillips, Kelly Ardong, and Dennis Pearson. Thank you all so very, very much.
Thank you.
Well, if you have been listening to this episode and thinking, man, I would really like to know more about Japan and listen to more episodes like this one and maybe search for other specific things about Japanese culture that I'm interested in, I will direct you to our website, which is sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. If you go to the episode list section specifically, we got a search bar there, and you can search for anything, and it'll show you exactly which episodes we talked about that thing in. I think it's pretty cool.
That is cool. You also broke it down really nicely into different categories, where all the regions are together, all the cities are together, all the cultural stuff is together. Makes it really easy visually to kind of find what you're interested in.
Yeah, you can just scroll through it and kind of look for things that interest you or focus in on things that might be useful to you.
Also, a really nice travel tools section.
Yeah.
If you're planning a trip, there's a packing list to make sure you don't forget anything. There's some resources for how you're going to do internet and other stuff while you're there.
Yeah, be sure to check it out. Paul, what are we talking about next time?
Our next episode is our Patreon-selected episode for this season. We are going to be talking about Akiya houses, or how you can buy a house in Japan.
Yeah, this will be interesting. I've been hearing a lot about these on Instagram and stuff. There are all these accounts that are like, oh, look at this house that you can buy for like $10,000 or something. And I always, you know, it really makes you want to start fantasizing about owning a house in Japan. And I haven't looked into it a lot, but I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to find out it's not nearly as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in your opinions as like a new home buyer.
Yeah.
How you're going to be like, oh, there's going to be so much work you got to do. Like, I'm interested to dive into this because I haven't started researching at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like a lot of home ownership has to do with what you're willing to put up with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you don't need to pour a ton of money into it, if you're okay with things kind of falling apart and like no air conditioning and no heat. Traditional Japanese homes, if we're talking hundreds of years ago, they were relatively simple, you know?
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot that you had to really keep up with.
You got paper doors and no central heating. That might not be fun sometimes.
Yeah. But if you're okay with that, you can own a home in Japan, no problem.
Hey, we'll find out next time.
Yeah, we will. I'm interested. I think it'll be tough research, maybe, but it'll be interesting. I'm sure we're going to learn a lot.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.